All right, well, on to my rant. Luke 18, starting with verse 22, a passage that's always bugged me, and so you get to be bugged with me today. Need a Bible, Ken?
Yeah.
I think there's one here.
Luke 18,
verse 22. You know the passage. It's where Jesus is speaking to the rich young ruler. He's told him, oh, you know the commandments. Yeah, I've done all that. When Jesus heard this, he said to him, you still lack one thing. Sell everything you have and give to the poor. That's the part that bugs me. Has that ever bugged you? Or am I the only one? You have been bugged by it?
Yeah.
I've been bugged by it. Because the reality is, the poorest among us here in North America are very wealthy. And, I don't know, I read a story Clifford Goldstein wrote, I think it was in the Adventist Review not too long ago. He was in India and was accosted by a mob of young men who wanted to shine his shoes while he was going into a meeting where he was going to preach about the Good Samaritan. And he didn't want his shoes shined, didn't need his shoes shined, but he said to himself, how can I go in here and preach about the Good Samaritan and ignore the beggar boys outside? So he let the kid shine his shoes, and he gave him a little bit extra. You know, I mean, I don't know how much he was charging, couple bucks or a dollar or whatever, and he gave him 5 or 10 or something, you know, gave him a little bit extra. And on his way back out of the meeting, that same little kid was there, and he said, please, mister, please, for $10 US, my friend here could buy a shoeshine kit. It will change his life forever.
$10.
And he's like, you know, how much is that going to hurt me?
Yeah, not much.
I can afford $10. How do I turn down a kid? This is, you know, it's going to change his life to have some means to, you know, begin to support himself, some work. We're rich.
Did he give the $10?
Yeah.
All
right. Good for a quick. Yeah. So I walked on. Yeah. No, I don't think he would have been writing about it. I feel, in our world, like a selfish pig.
Yeah.
Should I sell everything I have and give it to the poor? Do I have any right to have more than the poorest person on this planet? Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if everybody who had more sold their stuff and distributed it to people who had less until everybody was equal? Shouldn't we Christians, if anybody should be giving away our stuff to eradicate poverty? Well, that made me think. When Jesus tells the rich young ruler to sell his stuff and give it away, is he trying to eradicate poverty? Well, how do you know?
He did say he's trying to save the rich young ruler.
Hmm. No, indeed. Why does he tell the rich young ruler that he wants him? What does he say here in explanation of why he should do this?
He lacks one thing.
Yes.
One thing was hanging on his wealth.
Right, but the one thing that he lacks, actually, if we're going to talk about what he's missing, what is Jesus trying to get to him that he's lacking? According to here.
He's lacking treasure.
Treasure in heaven. Yes. Yes, and so Chester, you're absolutely right. He was not trying to eradicate poverty. He's trying to save the soul of this one person. And we, of course, can quote Jesus, the poor you will always have with you. Jesus was aware that because of the broken world in which we live, whether it's due to natural disaster or exploitation or war or laziness, there will be people among us who have less than others. And God arranged it in the ancient Hebrew economy that those who were having hard times would be motivated to better themselves, not just be taken care of by people who were doing better than they were. That's why they have the rules about gleaning. You know, you weren't allowed to go through your fields a second time to pick up all the little scraps. You had to leave that for the poor. But if the poor stayed at home, it would rot in your fields, right? The provision was there for those who had plenty to share some of their overflow.
But they had to work for it.
But they had to work for it. It wasn't collected by the wealthy landowner and delivered to their door in a box.
What a great system.
It was a wise system. But it was built on the reality that some people are going to be poor and that it's healthy for them to seek to better themselves and to have an active part in that. Yes?
In language at the time, he was actually a young, rich, and he was young, and so he was, his whole world was acquired.
Yeah.
And now he's being told to give.
Yeah. And in the context of this passage, I look back over at the parable of the shrewd manager, who was told, who we're told to emulate in some degree, and you all missed that sermon, that was a fun one, but we're told to emulate because he understood that relationships are more important than money. He understood that relationships are more important than money. And that seems to be one of the things that's missing with this guy. Money was very important to him, but people, relationships, the poor, off his radar screen. And so apparently we can't completely expect an end of poverty in this age. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. But I question whether selling possessions and giving them away to the poor could actually end poverty in our world. You know, the one person who's actually tried it was Jesus, who sold all that he had, expended all that he had to give to the poor, us. In a spiritual sense, true. But even so, in a spiritual sense, has he been able to eradicate poverty by doing that? No. Gifts do not always have their intended, do not always bring about their intended outcome. And you can give to someone and not necessarily solve the problem of poverty. In some cultures, the expectation is that if you have more of something than your neighbor, you'll give it to them. When I was in Papua New Guinea, I was talking with one of the expatriate missionaries, right, of the Australians probably. And they're saying, we could never understand why, hope the door doesn't blow around too much, why the women here go to the market every day or every couple of days and buy just a little thing of rice. Well, like, you'd save money if you went down and bought the 50-pound bag and brought it home and you wouldn't have to make a trip every day. You know, save yourself time and money. Why don't you do that? And without fail, all the people that they asked said, well, if I buy a 50-pound bag and I bring it home, all my neighbors come over and go, you got rice. Give us some. And pretty soon I'm left with one meal's worth. So it doesn't do me any good to go out and buy 50 pounds of rice because I can't keep it. So they go back to the store and buy it every day. Now, somewhere that breaks down because the guy who ran the store didn't do that. You know, you got rice. And ultimately, I think that kind of cultural idea is built around a subsistence, you know, just a survival culture, where if you found a cache of coconuts in the jungle and everybody back in your village is starving, you don't hoard it and charge them exorbitant prices for it or store it up in your house so that your family has something to eat and other people don't. I mean, that's the case where if you got it, you give it. But the problem is that when people could better themselves, when they're not living just totally hand-to-mouth, subsistence culture, that the remnants of that prevent people from ever doing any better. There's a lot of waste, whether it's packaging or trips to the store, or it's just more expensive to buy it in small amounts. And people won't better themselves, because if they do, they get chopped down like a tall weed. And so it ends up backfiring. And I don't see that in God's economy. You know, his intention, thou shalt not steal. All that intention that we can have personal property and that you're supposed to respect, this is yours and it's not mine, and that's okay. Is designed so that people will be motivated to go out and work and better themselves and their family and have something to contribute to the good of society. Chet and I have talked about this, and I've really appreciated some of the way he's described it. You know, God has given us all life force and energy. And you don't have to be a minister or, you know, the kinds of jobs that we go, oh, well, you know, you really should do that. No, there's all kinds of legitimate work. As long as it's contributing something useful to society, something that everybody can benefit from. Now, I'm not saying go and be a drug dealer, but something that you can do in an ethical way. We need people to be doing all of those different things and contributing something to society. But there are folks that live off of the hard work of other people, and they're just dragging the system down. But if everybody contributes something, and it doesn't have to be, you know, we need a great variety of things, everybody contributes something, then there's enough for all. And we get into trouble with poverty, where either people start hoarding and taking more than their share of stuff, or where people start leeching and not contributing something to the greater good, but still then wanting to live off of the work of other people. God didn't intend that kind of situation for his people, either the hoarding or the leeching. He really intended that people would be able to be blessed, to even stand out in being blessed. That's how he described to the children of Israel, I'll make you the head and not the tail. And you'll lend to many, but borrow from none. See, if the whole idea was that if anybody gets a little bit higher than anybody else, they should be chopped down and we should equal it all out, then what does all this language of blessing that God just uses mean? You know, he intended for people to be able to stand out in the crowd and to do better, not in the face of other people, but to become a channel of blessing. And if you have a sort of a doctrine that, you know, everything should be equal, that can't happen. And that wasn't how God intended it to be. Inequality is definitely the result of sin. But you can't wipe out sin by wiping out inequality. It doesn't get to the core issues. In some situations, inequality is appropriate or even deserved.
It's like the child left behind, where a lot of people pull their kids out of school because you have to have, the kids all have to be equal, but in order to bring the bottom kid up, you've got
to... You go to the lowest common denominator.
Teach to the lowest common denominator, yes. And all these teachers know that. There's legislative mandate, and whereas, you know, I remember in grade school, where I went, there was kids that were sent out of the classroom because they were basically... ahead of the rest of the class,
yeah.
They got to study the next grade level's book on their own,
mm-hmm.
and they could take those tests. And then there was kids that were getting lots of hands-on
maintenance,
so to speak. But there was a strata in the classroom of about 30 or whatever.
Right.
And we know what happens when they have to draw it all the fragmentation.
Yeah. And it's not realistic. In some cases, the inequality serves a purpose. Paul was the one who said, if anyone will not work, he should not eat. So that hunger is a motivation to, as he says in another place, those who have been stealing should stop stealing and go to work, so they'll have something to contribute to the whole.
Same thing in Christ's day. He sometimes wonder why he didn't specifically attack slavery, which
mm-hmm.
was but he did it, really, in his own way, which is to attack the heart.
Yes.
The heart.
And you get a longer term solution where really the entire culture was transformed, and many aspects it took a long time, but Christianity essentially ultimately led the way for the abolition of slavery in the Western world, because they understood by principle that it just does not work. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, the inclination or the thought that, oh, work is such a bad thing, you know, it's actually a good thing. And I think it's, that's why God says, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all your work. If you're busy doing things, you don't have time to get into mischief on the internet. Or you don't have, yeah. I mean, people who wouldn't have affairs in person go do goofy things on the internet, you know, and Christian people, yeah. You know, and if they were busy working from sunup to sundown, like, you know, like they did in the olden days, when yeah. men really had to go out and work hard and you know, work on their farms and whatnot, there's no time for mischievousness. And God knows our hearts, and He knows that. Not only so you can eat and things, but so that you can have...
But He tied it to things like eating.
Yeah.
So that we would be motivated.
Sure. But I mean, just besides that, like when we go to heaven, we won't be hungry, but we're still going to work there and labor. And that's good because it gives you a sense of accomplishment.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And it does. It keeps your mind active and sharper. And
yeah. Life is not about just existing. Right.
Yeah.
It's about doing something meaningful.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent. So, Jesus isn't trying to make the rich young ruler feel guilty, nor is He trying to make him feel responsible to end poverty. He's telling him to trade his treasures on earth for treasures in heaven. He's actually trying to do a little bit of money laundering. You know what money laundering is? It's where you take tainted currency and you trade it somehow for good currency. Well, the rich young ruler had a whole lot of stuff in his possession that was not going to last through the end of this world. And Jesus is trying to help him trade that in, make room in his safe, if you will, for some currency that can last forever. As Chet said before, he's trying to save his soul. Why does Jesus want him to have treasure in heaven so badly? Well, what comes to mind is, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And if your body's in heaven, but your heart is on earth, that's not eternal life, that's torture. And we Seventh-day Adventists, of all people, hallelujah, understand that God does not believe in eternal torture, right? But if the rich ruler's heart was here on earth, and Jesus took his body to heaven, he would be taking him to that other place. So Jesus is trying to get his heart in heaven, so that when his body goes there and joins it, he'll be happy to see it. So does that mean Jesus is speaking figuratively? Did he not really mean for the ruler to do literally what he told him? To sell his stuff and give it away? Was it just kind of a figure of speech? What do you think?
I think he meant it.
You think he really meant it? Well, let's look at it this way.
Then he says that then comes fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is going to be more of the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to be a continual watching how you give for others.
I got thinking, you know, thought about this from a lot of different directions, because I thought, well, if Jesus really wants him to sell everything and give it away, then Jesus must do the same thing himself. And we already talked a little bit about the sense in which Jesus did, but at this time, Jesus hadn't sold everything. He still owned his own clothes. You know how we know he owned his own clothes? Yeah, because they were gambling over him when he died. See, that was the point at which Jesus sold everything. It was only at his death. But he still possessed a few things. And so I got to think, well, on a practical level, right? If this guy started to, you know, sell off his stuff, and Would Jesus have stopped him at some points? Wait. You're taking this a little too literally now. Keep your toothbrush. Keep your clothes. And I got thinking, do we have any precedent in Scripture for God asking a very, very hard task of someone and then stopping them after it was clear they were willing to do it, but before they carried it out? Abraham and Isaac. And one of the reasons why this bugs me is because I read it and go, well, you know, if he told the rich young ruler to do it, and it was good for him to do, then isn't it good for all of us? Shouldn't we all be doing it? But when I read the story of Abraham, I don't think, well, if he told Abraham to sacrifice his son on an altar, isn't it good for all of us?
Or would he have stopped the rich man?
Yeah, and he hasn't asked anybody else in the Bible besides Abraham to do what he asked Abraham to do. So there must have been something specific about Abraham's situation. And it's fascinating because we turn a couple pages and here we find a rich man entering the kingdom of God. And the fascinating thing is, he says Zacchaeus is a son of Abraham. Salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. But Jesus never told him to sell all his stuff and give it away to the poor. Before Jesus ever says anything, Zacchaeus comes up with the idea, I'm going to give away half my stuff to the poor and I'm going to pay back anybody I've defrauded. But Jesus didn't tell him to do it.
Well, the fourfold thing is in Leviticus?
Yes. Yes, in that sense, but what I'm saying is, the rich ruler comes to Jesus with this, and in some sense, you know, to Jesus, it seems this glaring inconsistency. Oh, I want to be saved in heaven. While he apparently is hoarding wealth at the expense of poor people. And Jesus says, well, if you really want what heaven's about, you'd act like it here. Your heart's here. So he's dealing with an unconverted person at this point. And he's giving specific advice to him that he needs to hear because he's in danger of losing or is already on the wrong side of salvation because of his attitude toward his stuff. And I think that's what was going on with Abraham, that he was in danger of losing his salvation over his attitude toward his son. And God was saying to him, I gave you this gift, but it's not yours. And I'm asking you to give your son back to me. Everything the rich young ruler had was not his own. It was God's. And God has every right to tell any one of us at any point, oh, you're my business partner. Please liquidate the warehouse and send me the money. Well, I don't have any right to tell the master, the owner of my, you know, everything that I have, everything that I manage, I don't have any right to tell him, no, you can't liquidate the warehouse. I like some of that stuff. But the rich ruler didn't see it that way.
So that then the whole period went through, and at the end, Job was kind of like given up, and the Lord finally came to him.
Yeah.
But at that time, he said, let my servant Job pray for you.
That's right.
You know, he already there.
That's a fascinating story, and there was some growth for Job through that process, but he did understand that everything I have came from God.
Already understood that.
Yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, didn't the rich young ruler, it says in verse 23, went away sorrowful.
Yes.
He must have agreed with Jesus a little bit somehow, because he realized maybe Jesus is right, so and he's sad now all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's and I'm still not sure. That's something I'm still kicking around maybe for a future sermon. What was he sad about?
Good question.
When he was very rich.
But what is there to be sad about?
Being rich.
He wanted it, but not badly enough to actually sacrifice for it.
So what was he grieving if he went away sad? You understand what I'm asking? You know, if you're grieving, it's because you've given up on something and you have to say goodbye to it and you're letting it go. What is he grieving then if he went away sad?
I think he realized, well, I'm not sure it's realized the right word, but he saw his path was diverging. And he'd like not to take one of them to come together.
Yeah.
His path and this preacher.
So be specific for me. What is he saying goodbye to then?
Salvation.
It seems like he is grieving because he's keeping his stuff and he's saying goodbye to eternal life.
Yeah.
That is so sad.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you always wonder, he's a young ruler, you know? So you
maybe he got it later.
But the other thing is, maybe his mother had like really taught him. You know how we raise our children, and it's like you teach them sometimes you see people who they've been taught it and they know it by the books and everything, but it's not a heart conversion. It's a head thing. And maybe for him, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Maybe in his head, he knew that Jesus was who he was and that it was right, but his heart didn't feel it. And that's why maybe he grieved because it was like, you know what, I'm not going to be able to do what my mom wants me to do and what I know the church people think to be right. That's not for me.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think
when I'm old, maybe I'll come back to.
I mean, I think a lot of people that even I went to with things, you know, like on Facebook or whatever, it's like the same thing. They know it in their head, but they don't feel it in their heart. It's not a relationship with them.
And it's fascinating to me that Jesus is so harsh with this young man.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, we look at it and we just go, oh, I mean, that's kind of heartless. Why did he make it so hard for him? You know, I mean, Jesus didn't do that to anybody else. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell his disciples, oh, you got to sell everything you have. You know, they say down here, oh, we left everything to follow you. But what are they doing right after he's dead?
They go back to their
homes. They're back fishing. They got homes. They got families. They didn't sell everything and liquidate it all.
Yeah.
It's waiting there. They've still got nets. You know, they got all the tools of the trade. Yeah. So why does Jesus lay such a hard thing on this guy? It reinforced to me, at least, you know, we don't read hearts and we don't see everything, but we should not be ashamed to call people to be converted before they join the church. We should not back away. We should not make it so easy for people to join the church and make them so comfortable that people come in with no sense of the heart change that Christianity is about. And Jesus wasn't afraid to make it really hard for somebody who was showing plenty of evidence anyway that his heart was not there.
Yeah. Well, it's probably because he would have had an undue influence on all the other people. Because if he's a guy who didn't lack anything, and only Jesus seems to figure that out, and when Jesus points it out...
Yeah, the rest of the disciples are like,
Well, we've heard what you asked, then who can be saved, they said.
Yeah.
And Jesus replies, what is possible with men... is impossible with man is possible with God. So there's this, he would have had probably a large influence on other people, and that was shown just through that quick exchange, having just met
him. Right. They're all shocked.
With Jesus and going, whoa.
Right.
Probably a young church leader, actually.
Yes, that's what the term ruler means. It's a synagogue ruler.
Way, as it were, in. I mean, he was a doer.
And the disciples were like, great, a man of influence and power in the hierarchy. Let's let him in. I saw a presentation, part of a presentation this week. It was a list of descriptions of disciples. And it said everything from he loved Jesus and you know sought out his presence to, what were some of the other ones? He was well respected and influential with the other disciples to what was another one? He found pleasure in doing the work of God. And then the final one was he went out and hanged himself.
Yeah,
Every single one of them was a quotation about Judas from Desire of Ages. And you know, I was thinking about that again on this very topic of, you know, why did Jesus send this guy away? And how wise it would be for us, you know, to not make unconverted people so comfortable in church that we get the church full of unconverted people. Then why did Jesus have Judas? You know, was my question. Well, why didn't he send Judas away? And if I'm remembering right, some of what Ellen White comments about it is that the other disciples would not have understood. You know, that Judas kind of presented himself to be a disciple, and that he would have caused more waves by sending him away because they couldn't see his true character. But he didn't do that more than once, apparently. You know, he maybe knew the bigger picture of what was going to happen with Judas in that situation, and knew the prophecy, and that, okay, this is going to happen here. Yeah. And he all the other part of her comments are that, you know, he hoped by close association that he could actually get to Judas's heart. And it was safer for Judas to be with Jesus and the 12 than to be out there. But even so, he still wasn't able to reach him. But yeah, Jesus here took the risk of being totally misunderstood by his disciples and made it hard.
Do you think, are you saying that you maybe think there is a problem they have in this church with unconverted people?
There's a problem in the Christian church. Not just the Adventist church, but all around. Yeah. Christianity from the earliest days, when the persecution ended. That's right. When the persecution ended and you could be a Christian publicly, then yeah, we're excited to have people come join the church, whether or not their heart is in it. And you and I can't read hearts, you know. We're not the heart police.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't we should go out of our way to challenge people at the heart level. Absolutely. From the beginning. And if we can see clearly evidence that someone's heart is not converted, we should challenge them on that. We should stand for something on that.
Well, and another thing, kind of a little side tangent on that, is I think sometimes we want the numbers in our church so badly that we'll do the puppet shows and
and all of those things can be
movies or that.
Just right.
It's like, hey, they used us.
Right.
Let's take them to the movie.
They came.
Yeah, and then it's like, hey, look, our church is so full. But really, you know, is that what's important? It's like,
well, again, do we want bodies in the building and hearts somewhere else?
Right. We want to draw people to Christ.
No, we want hearts and bodies in the.
Yeah.
I think in evangelism, a lot of times we get to the tough sermons to preach, like the holy living, the jewelry, or whatever, you know. And we're just too afraid to really present it because, you know, the numbers are going to happen where Sabbath comes and it happens. Of course, you have to present the Sabbath, but then you get to some of the holier living things that Jesus would preach. Like riches, how hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom. We're afraid to say that because that's going to spin them out even more. We should only have one baptism in my series.
But of course, Jesus did then turn around and have rich people, like Zacchaeus. So he says how hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom.
I wonder how long Zacchaeus was rich after he joined the church.
I don't know.
Right there, see, before he makes that statement, in another context, he says, what is impossible of man is possible of God.
But that's just it. He says how hard it is, and they are, oh. But then he says, but God can do the impossible.
I think maybe that could mean, I just thought of this, maybe it means that riches acquired by your own, like man, when man acquires riches, that's impossible.
And,
but if God gives you the riches, it's totally possible.
Yeah, and it's not even, I don't think it's even, well, I don't know. I guess you could look at it whether it's man acquired or God given. I think the difference between man acquired and God given is how I perceive them. If I think that they're mine, not a gift from God, then that's man acquired, even if God gave them to me, because God's given me everything. And yes, that's all Jesus is getting at here with the rich ruler, is to get that heart change from, this is my stuff and it's more important to me to have it than to have God. That to, this is God's stuff, and He blessed me with it, and.
Well, like a rock singer, you know, even God didn't bless him. The guys Black Sabbath, they're making millions of dollars. God didn't give them those millions of dollars. They're earning that on their own.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, God makes us breathe and everything. But.
Yes, well, and I guess in that sense, it's true. I mean, where do they get the ability to sing? To do it, you know? Just like God gave Satan his life, and what's he done with it? One could make the case that God has blessed Satan with everything he has.
Although these people can't sing. but
you know, just the fact that we're alive and able to do anything is the gift and mercy of God. And everything we have, whether we're a rock singer or a drug dealer, or it's still God's. All right. Jesus ultimately told the rich ruler to do something that for him was necessary, but not sufficient. I believe he was serious, and he really did want him to go and sell everything he had. I suspect that he probably would have stopped him at some point and said, "You're beginning to get the point now. Have you found a heart for people? Have you begun to love and care about people? Keep your toothbrush, keep your clothes. You know, don't become a burden on other people. Keep enough resources that you can continue to support yourself and have something to contribute. Keep your tools, if you will, right? Your fishing boat, your net, whatever it is that allows you to make a livelihood.
Those things you can give to God too, though, can't you? Like your business, your pets, your fishing boat.
Yes, although if you sell them and liquidate them and just pass them off.
Then they're not of use to you or God or anybody.
Yeah, potentially. And that's one of the things that sort of bothered me about this. And I suspect that, again, Jesus was trying to get him to find a different source of security. Not trying to make him a burden on society. I don't know if you've ever read Martin Luther's comments about the monasteries in his period, but there were vast numbers of monks who had taken vows of poverty. And they went into these monasteries. But they weren't doing anything useful in the monasteries. They weren't producing anything. So they would go out and beg off of poor peasant people, you know, and use all kinds of superstition to tell them, "Oh, you'll get extra points in heaven if you give me, because I've dedicated my life to holiness and to, you know." But they were essentially just leeches on the society. And Martin Luther, you know, just absolutely railed against this whole practice. And of course, when Lutheranism sprung up in Germany and the monasteries were all closed and all the monks had to go out in the world and get a job, the economy significantly improved. So there is definitely, Jesus is not trying to say that it's holier to be poor. Right? That somehow if you take vows of poverty and stop producing anything useful in society and just become a leech off of other people, that's a good thing. That's not a good thing. God intended for us to 6 days shalt thou labor and to have something to contribute to the larger society. But we often, at least I've gotten the impression from this verse, that it's holier to be poor. And it's rampant in church.
Or that it's sinful to be rich.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I mean. Those are the same thing in my mind. They're two sides of the same coin. And, you know, we say, well, we won't wear jewelry, but people drive Mercedes and BMWs. Well, I've said that myself. And the reality is, there is such a thing as excess, right? There is such a thing as hoarding wealth when it could be used for a beneficial purpose. But, you know, sometimes you save money by buying something good once in 30 years than by buying something trashy 6 times in 30 years.
My dad always tries to teach us.
Yeah.
Quality.
If you, and you spend more money at the outset, but you save money in the long run. Chet was telling me about rich people, mortgage their, is mortgage the right word?
They're kind of all kinds of things, like they did surveys of people that buy new cars. The people that bought new cars of the wealthy, like 50% of the wealthy people apparently that are like more than millionaires, they don't buy new cars, they buy used. But the ones that bought new had businesses that their relationships were dependent on. Like, for instance, I'm a paving contractor. I buy a new vehicle because not only is it a tax write-off, but the likely people that I will pay about every 5 years in reciprocating business is the car lot.
Yeah.
I have all the car lots in town, so I rotate by buying my stuff from them. There was legitimate reasons, like, that goes into people that choose as an attorney or some of these other professions, if you drive a used car, you simply will not get business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that's the case.
But it's part of the tools of the trade.
When they had interviews for the next city attorney that came, I mean, they all drove Volvos or BMWs, and mm-hmm. the local town county drives a Cadillac. And mm-hmm. if he came up and drove what I drove, you know, a little Toyota 4x4 pickup, he probably wouldn't get the job. They go,
He's not an attorney.
And so, you know, we have these things, and I always think it's interesting because one of my Catholic friends is very, the church has got it instilled in this wealth redistribution equality thing. Where do you draw the line? At what point do you have to say?
One of the things that I remember you talking about was people actually look at, you know, I'm going to buy a more expensive suit, but it's going to last me 15 years. And so I'm actually saving money by doing this, you know, looking at it over the long haul. Or a more expensive pair of shoes, but I'm going to wear it longer and I can get it resold and that sort of thing.
And I've interviewed some of the old people and they know, they've worked the math on how much it costs them per wearing of their shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they ask them, well, why do you buy, you know, how come you buy these $140 shoes, you know? And the guy goes, well, these outfits me, you know, 13 cents per wearing.
Yeah.
And the kids that are over there wearing these tennis shoes, it cost them 32 cents per wearing.
Yeah.
You know, and then you were totally taken back. And he goes, explains for like 3 pages the math, and it's true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
the reality is, it's expensive to be poor.
That's true. They get poor, do spend a lot of money on interest and credit cards, just little things.
All those paycheck advance places.
Yeah.
What neighborhoods are those in?
Yeah, four.
And so people who can't afford their rent are paying, you know, $30 on every paycheck to get it a couple days early so they can pay their rent.
For example, you gave of New Guinea. That's a culture of
poverty. It's expensive because they got to take their time and go down to the store and come back every day.
And that was exactly. Gas station. You know, when I worked there when I was 12, I was working in the whole thing. And this lady came in and chewed us out when they were rebuilding the station. I told you the story before. Across the street. And this lady she just railed again. I had never come to the station. The only reason I'm buying gas from you is because they're rebuilding over there. And, you know, they're always cheaper and you guys are always a penny more. Which the reality is, no matter how my stepdad would move the price, the guy on 32 stations or whatever.
And the guy across the street.
He always moved it one penny lower. And he'd come over and say, lower, it's too low. And so this lady, I'll never forget, she had two children in there, I believe it was. And after she did that, she didn't buy a full tank of gas. She bought like 3 or 4 gallons. So that's a whopping 3.5 cents. She's yelling at us, and then she bought candy bars for her children, which are completely overpriced.
At a convenience store.
And she said, well, I'll have a pack of Marlboros.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to me, I was like, wow, because
that's how the poor live. The cigarettes come before
anything. Yeah, all those things.
My mom lived like that.
And the junk food, you know, people who are living, they're working two jobs so that they can do whatever. They don't have time to make food. So all the fast food places crop up there. And it costs more money to buy the food, and it's bad for their health, so it's, you know, more expensive in terms of health and, you know, everything else. It's expensive to be poor. You know, it costs more money. It's hard. You can't drive to the suburbs to Costco because you don't have your own car. And you can't afford the $50 to join Costco to buy stuff that's cheaper. And you don't have a big enough house to store it all. And you can't afford the electricity on the freezer. And, you know, so it's expensive. It's a vicious cycle as far as that goes. And so it's a blessing to be able to have enough to make more, you know, to have the right tools for your trade, whatever those may be, whether it's the suit or the BMW or the, you know, whatever it is, to be able to make more. You've heard the fable of the goose that laid the golden eggs, and the guy gets greedy and he goes and kills the goose so he can get the golden eggs out. Only, as you know, the eggs are not just in there someplace. So his supply of golden eggs just ended. Well, that's what some people do with their resources. And I've run into a few people who are so freaked out that their money might get burned up in the end of time that they're trying to get rid of it to other people so they won't be held responsible. Yeah. And I've asked in a couple of cases, it was from people that I knew fairly well, and I was like, why are you're not even able to pay your own insurance or, you know, whatever bill. Why are you trying to get rid of this money? Well, it's all going to be burned up anyway. Okay, but if you're not, you know, do you have a budget? Are you? No. Well, then you can't bypass your responsibility to be a good steward of that money by just giving it to somebody else. You should retain enough goose, right, to get some golden eggs. And if you just kill the goose or give it away to somebody else, then we've got to take care of you. And you become a drain on the rest of us. Manage your own resource, what God has blessed you with, wisely. Don't kill the goose. Keep what you have and put it to work. Make it do something worthwhile. Now, if you've got a budget and you're doing fine and this is excess and extra and God has laid it on your heart to bless my ministry or whatever, fine. Right? But if you're not surviving and you're not, don't give away what God has given you. Invest it.
Well, there's a time for planting and time for harvest. I think that it's outside the context of rulers. But like Joseph, he had instructions to, there was a vision. And so 7 years they collected the plenty. But what would have happened if at the other end,
he hadn't given it out?
You know, charging people exorbitant prices.
If he had hoarded it.
They had hoarded the time of famine. So there was a time to be distributing what God had blessed with. But likewise, God had given a vision that he was able to rule the kingdom to be saving.
And
it wasn't at the expense of Joseph.
Yes. And she was saying, but Joseph didn't make himself a burden on other people in the process either. You know, he was taken care of in that process also. And it really brings an interesting connection, because one of the things that came to my mind while I was wrestling with this, you know, why are you trying to give this money away, was some of Ellen White's statements where she implies, now I'm going to say this one way and it's going to make it sound kind of funny, but she implies that we will be held responsible for what our children do with the inheritance that we give them. Now, I don't think it's like this, because this is how I initially thought of it. Okay, I'm in a saved condition when I die, and I give the money to my children. And if they use it to support it as written ministry, then I stay saved. And if they go to the casino, then my status changes. I don't think that's what she's getting at, right? But the point that she's making is, you cannot, you will be held responsible if you just try to shove your stewardship onto somebody else's lap. You're the one that was given stewardship of whatever resources that was, and you need to take ownership of it. And people who simply neglect to do it, or who give their money off to unbelieving children, you know, who are not going to channel any of that money back into God's cause, are going to be held responsible for their final act of stewardship when they die. Yeah, some fascinating.
I'm just reading
all that. Some fascinating stuff. Some of the quotes, and I've got them bookmarked in here. She says, the only condition in which you really ought to give large sums of money away to your children are if you know that they have more of a heart for God than you do, and that they're going to figure out a way to get more of that money back into God's work than you would. But the interesting analogy for me is, anybody here ever driven a company car? You ever worked for some place that, all right, when you left the company, did you give the car to your kids?
No.
Why not?
Not
mine. Right. And so we're in business with God, right? He's our partner. And he has said, all right, I'm sending you out here in business. You're to manage everything. I'm going over to Malibu or wherever, you know.
I'm going to heaven.
Yeah. And I expect every month for you to send me 10% of the profits. Right, that's my return on investment. It's all, I've set it out. That's what 10% of the profits comes to me. That's mine. The other 90% is yours to live on, to support your family and you know, whatever you want to do. And we go, wow, this is great. I mean, I get to keep 90% of the business. It's his business, but he lets me manage the 90% and only requires that I give him 10% back. That's great. How can I say thank you? I mean, this is a wonderful setup for me. And you try to send him some extra money. And he says, no, just the 10%. So you go, well, how in the world am I going to express my gratitude? Ah, I know what I'll do. I know of a cause that he cares about. You know, Muscular Dystrophy Association or, you know, whatever it is. I'm going to take out of my 90%, you know, that I have my discretion to do with, and I'm going to support this cause in his name. And that's our offerings, right? The tithe is God's 10%. He doesn't ask for any more than that. If we try to give him more than 10% of tithe, it's not tithe anymore. It's offerings. It's the above and beyond. It's the how can I express my gratitude that he's letting me live off this 90%. But when I die, the whole thing still belongs to him. And the 90% that is in my possession and whatever I've gained off of investments or whatever with that isn't mine to keep. It isn't really even mine to give to my children. It's his. And really, the only legitimate disposal that I could make of it is either to give it directly back to him or to give it back to, or to pass it on to the next steward, if you will, of the business. Now, if that happens to be my children, right, who I know have more of a heart for God than I do and are going to do better with that than I would were I to live long enough to dispose of it, fine. But if not, you know, Ed Reed tells the story of his mom calling him up and saying, we're redoing our wills and so on. And apparently he has two brothers or a brother and sister that are not in the church and a couple that are. And she says, you know, we're feeling very convicted about this, but we're afraid that your brother and sister are going to be upset if we don't, you know, give them a bunch of stuff in the will. And he said, well, here's what I would do. Leave us each $500. You know, as a gift. So we can get to your funeral, you know, and it won't cause us any inconvenience. And then, you know, give the rest back to God as you see fit. But there, the connection here for me is that at some point, Lord tarrying, all of us are going to sell everything we have, whether we like it or not. And our wealth will be redistributed. And the question is, will it be according to God's values or not? And if you die without a will in the state of California, they will assume you're an atheist. Right? I mean, they'll pass it on to your children, but they will not assume that you had any charitable intentions with your possessions.
That's interesting. As this was going along, more and more I was substituting in my mind our sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was really dealing with it. Because obviously this young ruler, he was giving the ten.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was doing everything right. He said so.
Yes.
And so his sense of security, he was now wanting to finalize it, linking up with this great teacher to make himself very secure in the hereafter. And instead, the teacher makes him totally insecure.
Yeah.
And he goes away sorrowful, insecure feelings. Mm-hmm. And in our day-to-day, that's what happens to a lot of people that have their security tied up in the stock market or whatever. It crashes. And that is a real big lesson to go through all of this. And even this sense of, he didn't actually ask him. He asked him to give away his 90%,
mm-hmm.
which was his security.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the links I was making is that all of us are going to have to give up that 90% when we die.
Yeah.
And the question is, what happens with it? And do we plan, as good stewards, that would be distributed according to God's values? One way or the other. I don't know, Chet's talked about this a little bit. You know, in our society, it's hard for, you know, every generation sort of has to start over again and you can't build on the work that your parents did, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be able to pass down some property and, you know, farms and that sort of thing? Should church grandparents have sold the farm and given the money to God? Or is it okay for the farm to stay in the family? And I, you know, so I kind of kicked that around a little bit. You know, just sort of a raw reading of some of this. You kind of go, well, no. When you die, you got to roll up everything, and you give your kids $500, and you... And I don't think that's the point. But I do think that if your children are God-fearing people, and you can leave the goose that lays golden eggs, right, in their possession somewhat intact, in other words, the ability to continue to make resources, Ed Reed talks about it in terms of education. You know, he says, you owe your kids a good education, and with a good education, they can support themselves. But in ancient times, it was a farm, right? You weren't going to give your kids education. You were going to leave them the land. And so we need some flexibility to think about these things. It doesn't mean that, you know, when you die, everything that you have needs to be rolled up in a ball and sent to the conference.
The whole provision, if that had happened, you had screwed up the whole Jewish...
Absolutely.
Because it was based on a set of rules...
That the land passed from family to family.
...but it was appointed in 40, and that there was the Jewish leader who followed the rules. And, you know, like, you could redeem your... property or whatever back.
Yeah.
So and then you have all those horrible things where people were coveting someone's vineyard and all those stories, but clearly God's design was designed to make sure there was provision for each person that lived in that country. Yeah. And
from generation to generation.
Someone would mismanage and screw up, but he still had a system designed so they wouldn't be oppressed by people and have the capacity to redeem and come back. So each person had something. And so I always looked at it in that context and said there's certainly, because in our modern society, when people have nothing, a good part of your life is your perpetual
right.
debt
cycle. Yeah. So we should take that into consideration, you know, that we should, unless we know we're causing more problems than good. In other words, if we're giving money to unbelieving people who are going to ruin their lives with it, just because they're our children, that's probably not a good idea. But to give family some leverage, to be able to have the capacity to do more with their lives, that's probably a good thing. And whether you do that through education or, you know, property or whatever it is, I think that's in harmony with the principles and with what we see in Scripture. God is not in the business of making people poor. Right? Is that clear? When he tells the rich young ruler to sell his stuff and give it away, it's not because he's trying to make him poor. He's trying to get at his heart there. And throughout the Old Testament, God said, I want to bless you and make you a blessing. The implication is that when you become a converted person, then God can give you more stuff. I mean, it's not just that he's trying to pad us and make us, you know, wealthy. This is not the health and wealth gospel. But if God knows that his 10% return on investment is coming back to him, and that your heart is with him and his causes, won't he want to funnel as many resources into your care and keeping as possible? Because he knows it's going to go to the place that he wants it to go. Wouldn't he want you as his business partner to prosper? I think so. And I think we see that. If you look at, you know, the generations of families, as one generation becomes Christian, and maybe they come out of poverty, and, you know, the parents had bad health habits or, you know, other things, and the next generation, the kids get an education, and they go on and they do, you know, they're a little bit healthier, their lives are a little more stable. The next generation, maybe the kids go to college or become professionals. Christianity has that effect on people, that God brings more stability and health into their lives. I'm going to buy one.
You got loose.
I think sometimes we try to hand off our resources too quickly for fear of being contaminated by them instead of accepting it as a challenge from God and a responsibility from God to make more with it, to gain more capacity to do more good. If somebody's got to be at the top of a big corporation managing all those resources, don't we want somebody with values, Christian values, doing that? You know, why do we farm out politics and the media and wealth to unbelievers. You know, and we end up with corruption in government. Because we don't want to be corrupted, so we don't go into government or politics. But that means we're handing it off to people who are not planning to be in heaven. And as long as there's some legitimate, ethical way of conducting business, don't we want someone with morals and ethics doing it? I'm not telling you to go out and be a drug dealer, all right, because they handle a lot of resources. But if there's an ethical way to conduct any business, Christians shouldn't be afraid to do it. And to be blessed doing it. And to maybe even become wealthy doing it.
One thing that would speak to that somewhat is, other than hard assets, all other soft assets, such as your skills, mm-hmm. your mental powers, the writer, Hemingway, mm-hmm. You can't pass off his style of writing, be as famous through his children down the lines.
Yeah.
They try. And you see that in the political realm. You see it in the legal, or the light kings. And I somewhat of a minor studier of history. And often the most conscientious, deep-thinking king or queen would be followed by an utter reprobate.
Yeah.
Almost
invariably, right?
And the thought you gather is critical to these values off.
Yeah.
So it gets back to this, you know, it needs to be returned to God to be used correctly.
After listening to your thing, I want to give it to because I never really thought of it in this context. But I have an employee who is older, near retirement, and he's very knowledgeable. And so you could argue that, wow, he's one of the best qualified at that profession if he does. We almost had an employee get killed because he has been for years, 32 years, absorbing everybody else's knowledge. So you couldn't argue that he's the one that knows, but he doesn't share what everyone else has shared with him. And so he didn't go and tell somebody, yes, that's a 220 line, it's buried in that location. So someone, literally, the guy almost got electrocuted. We were furious. Why didn't you share what you knew?
The resources you had.
The resources you had available to you. But the thing is, if you look, you know, people can say, oh, well, that's an outstanding employee. Because look at all the knowledge they have. And look at all the stuff they can do. And they can fix problems. And they can do this. But all he's been doing is collecting from other people all these years.
Yeah.
And we have a near death of another employee because he doesn't.
So that's an example.
That there's a time to take and there's a time to give.
It's an example of hoarding.
It's the hoarding thing. And what your thing is pointing, maybe Zacchaeus had it figured out, or maybe these other people, but you're maybe this guy, because I've always struggled with the verses that we're dealing with here, because people are always quoting, oh, maybe what direction? Certainly some of my friends, and this, I think, prevails in America. But this deployed example is kind of what, I mean, maybe this guy, he had all the best teaching, and if I didn't know that he was some kind of ruler synonymous with the guy that worked in the synagogue.
Yeah, it's a religious
ruler. Absorbing all the latest and greatest teachings that people have learned, you know, hearing all the best sermons, ideas, you know, from sermon ideas for pastors and all that, but he's not related to anyone else, and there's a reflection of that same thing going on with his wealth.
Finances. Yeah.
Then maybe that's
what
he was trying to get at.
We even address the
not in this particular sermon. What about it were you thinking of?
Well, you were talking about redistribution of wealth. And
oh, well, you know, it is fascinating that in the Christian church, you know, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, who were saved as rich men, spent most of their lives supporting the church. Their wealth went back into the work of God. And I don't think they died rich. But that's just it. We should be excited to be blessed and have the opportunity to share. We should, as far as possible, to keep the goose alive, right? Not just give away all our money. We as but one way or another need to retain the capacity to earn more. to keep the tools of the trade, to keep supporting ourselves and our family. But there reaches a point in your life, right, where accumulating and accumulating more is not actually going to be useful. And you need to start paring down and paring down and paring down so that when you die, you don't have this huge, massive stuff that now somebody else has to be the steward of. And so Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea spent a good chunk of their lives distributing the wealth that God had entrusted them with so that when they died, they didn't die with a whole bunch of money sitting around that could have been used. They could have taken responsibility to distribute themselves. So there is kind of a curve.
Acts chapter 5 that troubles a lot of people because it's a situation where the church, everybody sells everything they have and just dumps it into the church. And then the church
distributes it. It's not actually quite that simple. It was as people had need. So when somebody was in trouble, other people didn't say, well, I don't really care about your trouble. I'm sitting on this property over here that's worth a lot of money, but I don't really care about your trouble. People were convicted when there was a need, and the church actually handled the distribution of it, so it wasn't just one person selling the property and giving the money to someone else. But it was as people had need. It wasn't just, they dumped everything and just threw it in the pot and said, let's live communally now. Not quite like that.
Well, the wording sort of is kind of tricky, I guess.
Yeah.
They didn't consider anything their own.
Right.
Sold off that they had.
Yeah. But the understanding that I have anyway is at least the impression that I've gotten was, again, not that they just sort of dumped it all in the pot, but was, if you have a need, I don't consider this mine that I can keep the resources I have from you. It was like we're a family. And when I write a check and I don't have enough in my account to cover it, it comes out of Karina's account, And if she buys me a present, guess who's paying for it?
You are.
Yeah, because we don't consider my money and my checking account my own and hers her own. It belongs to all of us, or in the bigger sense, it belongs to God. And so I'm not going to keep it back if there's somebody else who's in need.
And then there's the goose that lays the egg. Yeah, people that you have that back chapter.
Yeah.
In Matthew 6, God, verse 33 says,
seek first his kingdom and his righteousness and everything else.
Everything.
And with that is a whole realm of taking care of my health and getting an education and, all those things that give me the capacity to be a blessing and to take care of my own family. So I don't want to throw out my health. I don't want to throw away my tools that I use. I don't want to do something that's going to destroy my capacity to earn a living and take care of my family. But all those are in subjection to, they come underneath. If I can earn a living and I don't have God, then what was the use of that? So, the big question is, are you converted? Because Jesus told the unconverted guy, your money's in the way. But with people who are converted, he says, I want to bless you and make you a blessing. And I trust you with my stuff more than I trust the person who's not planning to be in heaven. So that's the question to start with. And if you're converted, then I would suggest, I'm not promising you health and wealth, but I would suggest that you can probably expect to be more stable in your finances and your health and all kinds of other things so that you can be more of a blessing than if you're not. So, if there's anything in this world that you would say yes to and no to God, now's the time to say, Lord, help me. But if not, don't be afraid of being blessed. Don't think that it's somehow evil to have God put resources into your care and keeping. If he gives you resources, maybe it's because he trusts you with them. Honor him to the best of your knowledge and seek to become a blessing with him. Let's pray. Father God, you are the source of abundance and abundant life. And from that life, we have the capacity to care for our own needs, for our families, to be a blessing to others. And Lord, I'm excited that you are in the business of blessing, that you've got so much good that you want to share, that you can't hold it back. Lord, I want to be at peace in my own heart about being blessed and being a blessing. I pray that you'll open my eyes and my heart, that my heart may be in tune with yours, in harmony with yours, that I may be the kind of person that you would love to bless, because you trust me as the steward of your goods. In Jesus' name, amen.